from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum, we are all traumatized by life, writes Buddhist psychiatrist and author Mark Epstein. But this isn't necessarily a bad thing, he says in his new book, The Trauma of Everyday Life. Epstein says trauma, from death of a loved one to everyday suffering like fear, has its benefits, and that understanding and accepting trauma can lead to personal growth and change. He'll join us in studio for the hour, coming up next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Mark Epstein, MD, psychiatrist and Buddhist, joins us in the studio for the second Forum hour. He's the author of Thoughts Without a Thinker and Psychotherapy Without the Self, and his most recent book is The Trauma of Everyday Life. And we welcome him to Forum for this morning's second hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Hey, thank you so much.
Well, let's begin by talking about trauma. We did a program earlier this week on the empty nest, and I actually referenced a statement you made about the empty nest being a trauma. And Joshua Coleman, who is here in studio, a psychologist, said trauma is too strong for empty nest. And you talk about everyday and ordinary traumas, and you talk about really what I suppose some people would consider just angst or disappointments or failures and so forth. So tell me about why those constitute traumas in your mind.
Well, I think trauma exists across the spectrum, and we're used to thinking about it as, you know, only occurring in situations of big trauma, like in war, or, you know, when you're confronted with someone dying, some horrible catastrophic thing. But I think what we can learn from those big traumas are that the defenses that are put into use, you know, in people who end up with post-traumatic stress, those are common defenses. And we use those defenses in our everyday life in confronting the smaller traumas, I say, the smaller difficulties, the smaller obstacles that face all of us at one time or another in our lives. We respond to those the same way that people in war respond to those big traumas, the way that a kid whose parent commits suicide responds. You know, that's intrinsic to who we are, and I think we can learn from those big traumas how to deal with our smaller ones, including the empty nest, which is a trauma.
Well, you say there are many forms of trauma. No one escapes them, and they spare no one, and I certainly agree with you when you're using this continuum of traumas. But also, you say face them head on. The way out is through. Accept them.
Yeah. I don't actually say accept them as much as acknowledge them, because I think the process of accepting is a long one, and who knows if we ever really totally accept them. But simply to acknowledge the feelings that are elicited by all the difficulties that we face, that's a huge step. And I'm definitely encouraging people to do that. I think we can do that more than we think we can. I got a letter today from a woman who's a 46-year-old woman whose father killed himself 8 days before she was going to leave for college when she was 17. And her mother said, you know, like, get on with it. No one would talk about it. And she read a piece of mine now 30 years later and said, oh, thank you so much. My mother told me I was doing it wrong, but I know there's a hole in my heart where my father was, and I have to learn. And then I think she mistyped on her phone. She said, I have to learn to love with it. And I think she meant I have to learn to live with it. But the message was she could still love her father, even in her grief.
You know, instead of shutting it all away. Even when you're typing a letter.
Like, yeah, it's a Freudian slip on the iPhone.
Well, I remember reading an article you did in Psychology Today. You were talking about happiness as being the purpose of life. And I want to get back to your book. But, you know, you're quoting the Dalai Lama and saying this is as much a drive, a fundamental drive in us as really, you know, any sex, hunger, and so forth. And I think it's probably true. And yet so much of Buddhism, so much of the vision of Buddhism has to do with suffering. And I wonder, in fact, how that balance comes through, especially where trauma is concerned. Maybe we can just locate that as you see it and crystallize it. It's as if somehow you're saying you can go through this path and you can integrate it and you can move on, but at the same time, the dukkhas and all that they represent in the way of suffering are going to be there.
Yeah. Well, I actually think all the talk recently about happiness, you know, how achievable happiness is and happiness is our right and so on, I think it's a little bit overdone, the happiness thing. I actually think that we all have like a set point for happiness, like the way a thermostat, you know, and we hover around that point. And we can't do very much to, you know, maybe a tiny bit we can adjust the thermostat, but each person has their own degree of happiness.
Well, I'm with you. I believe in set points very strongly. But the question is, if you have set points which make you downbeat and make you look at the cup half empty as opposed to half full, can make a great deal of difference in terms of not even so much happiness. That article I mentioned, you say, receive the pleasant without grasping and the unpleasant without condemning. And
yes.
That's really good axiomatic advice.
It's good advice, and it comes directly from Buddhist psychology. And what they're teaching there is that there's maybe a different kind of happiness, which has more to do with establishing a feeling of equanimity inside, where you know that you can face the disagreeable, and you know that you can also accept the pleasant without grasping. And there's a different feeling. I'm not sure I would call it happiness anymore, but a kind of peacefulness maybe.
Does it mean detachment, or does it have to mean detachment?
There's some element of detachment in it. I think people misunderstand the detachment. I always tell this story about a teacher of Jack Kornfield's I met in Thailand who was giving a teaching about that, about what detachment means. And he held up his drinking glass and he said, you know, I love this glass. Do you see this glass? It holds the water admirably. When the light strikes it, it has a lovely a glow to it. When I strike it myself, it has a lovely ring. But when the glass falls, you know, for me, the glass is already broken. When the wind blows, when I knock it off the shelf and it falls, I say, of course. But because I know that the glass is already broken, every minute with it is precious. And it's that every minute with it is precious thing that comes with a little bit of detachment. It's not that we don't care about our lives or each other or our bodies or ourselves or the glass. You know, every minute with it is precious. That's the feeling that can be derived from a willingness to be with the disagreeable aspects of things also.
We're talking with Mark Epstein, MD, psychiatrist and author most recently The Trauma of Everyday Life, and he's also clinical assistant professor in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at New York University, and will be at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 7 p.m. this evening. There is in so many people, a feeling of emptiness, and you write about this. In fact, you say a disciplined mind is the road to nirvana, again, echoing the Buddha. So we think about mindfulness, we think about clear comprehension. But you also talk about juggling, and for many people, life is all about juggling. I mean,
yes,
all the things they have, the tasks they have, the good and the bad, the vacillation and so forth. That metaphor works in line with your thinking, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it worked in a very concrete and practical way for me. When I was learning how to meditate, some friends of mine taught me how to juggle. And it wasn't until they showed me what juggling was that I could really understand what meditation was. You know, there's an art to meditation and there's an art to life. And if we only approach it as a science and as a, you know, a practical set of steps that we get from a workbook, we miss the finesse of it, you know, and we miss the nuance of it, and we don't necessarily do it the way the Buddha was encouraging us to.
Well, in fact, you think you talk about Buddhism as both an art and a science. Some would think maybe Buddhism and Eastern philosophy and psychoanalysis pretty much rooted in that Viennese bourgeois burger, Sigmund Freud, that these two, you know, East is East and West is West and never the twain.
Well, I had the unusual experience of learning all about Buddhism for maybe 5 or 6 years before I even had the idea of becoming a Western therapist, before I went to medical school. So I always listened to everything I was learning in my training as a Western psychiatrist with a kind of third ear as to whether it was consistent with what the Buddha taught or not. And, you know, Freud gave instructions to physicians practicing psychoanalysis, and his main instruction was suspend your judgment and give impartial attention to everything there is to observe. Don't bother about keeping anything in mind. Listen to your patient's unconscious with your unconscious. There couldn't be a more Buddhist description. You know, if you didn't know it was Freud, you would think it was Suzuki Roshi or somebody.
There's something soulful and artistic in that, too. I remember Bruno Bettelheim, although a terrible man in many ways, you know, wrote this article about how the word psyche implies an intuitiveness and, you know, allowing yourself to sort of interface in a soulful way.
Yeah.
And we become so scientized in terms of psychoanalysis. But
I think the word psyche has something to do with breath also,
yes,
which has always been interesting to me, since we watch the breath in meditation and the breath sort of unifies the body and mind. We're used to thinking of those as two separate things, but they must be one thing on some level.
Well, you write about many of your patients here, and there's one that you write about who comes to you, and he's got a terrible diagnosis, and a myeloma, and he says, you know, I don't necessarily need sympathy. I need something
other
else than that. And you get into the realistic view, this noble eightfold path of the Buddhas, but the idea that, once again, one has to face the reality of whatever it is, whatever the diagnosis is, whatever the bad news is.
Yeah. Well, you know, the word the Buddha used for the first noble truth, you know, which many people think he said life is suffering, but really he just said dukkha, you know, just dukkha. And dukkha means hard to face. Duk is hard, and ka means face, difficult to face or hard to face. And he said in the first noble truth, you know, like, it's hard to face, but we have to learn how to face it. And if you do that, other things will happen for you that can take you out of your own self-preoccupation and your fear and your worry.
You have a lot of what I would categorize as psychobiography of the Buddha himself.
That's what I was setting out to do at first.
And it's fascinating because, you know, he lost his mother at such an early age. Wait, it was 7 days after he was
born.
So he really didn't have a mother.
No, well, his mother's sister was also married to his father, so she stepped in and took over. But he had this loss at a time before he could know what was really happening to him. And I think that was like a metaphor laying in wait for the age of psychoanalysis, you know. Why should the Buddha have to lose his mother at the age of a week? Why is that fact there?
Couldn't even develop a normal Oedipus complex, I suppose you could say.
No.
But the fact is, though, that he abandoned his own child to go out on a spiritual quest.
Well, that's part of what I'm saying in the psychobiography part, that he's acting out or enacting the same loss, the same trauma that happened to him. He replayed it by leaving his young child and his wife. And that's a disturbing story in Buddhism. It makes us all wonder, you know, should we be leaving, talk about empty nest, should we be leaving our wife and child in order to really pursue the Buddha's path? And obviously, I think no, but I think the Buddha was dealing with some deep stuff in his psyche that it took the 6 years of his search in the forest to work through.
And the age that we come to in understanding the Buddha was 29. That's when he began to really confront old age and death.
Yeah. Well, you know, his overprotective father, after the mother died, tried to raise him never to see old age, illness, and death. That's the story. And then when he was 29, suddenly he was his charioteer, took him out into the real world. And he saw an old person, an ill person, and a corpse, and that shocked him. So that was a trauma for him, and it set him on his path.
If Buddha is a central figure in your work, at least in terms of Buddhism and how that influenced you, I would say Winnicott is maybe
Winnicott's the central figure in the
psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
And particularly when it comes to the ideas of blending meditation and mindfulness. But I always remember a quote of Winnicott's that just grabbed me. He said, the purpose of psychoanalysis is to turn ghosts into ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He also said, it's a joy to be hidden, but a disaster not to be found. That's my favorite thing from him.
Well, speaking of favorite things, you know, when it comes to trauma, there are one of the favorite words you hear from people who are trying to sometimes offer comfort or empathy is closure. The person needs closure and everything.
Yeah.
And the reality is, and I'm talking about, I think the reality as I see it is, for some people there is no closure, especially with great losses that they grieve their whole life and are bereaving.
Well, I think for some people, closure, if it's going to come, comes in a way that they don't anticipate. And when people are trying to fit themselves into a formula for grief, you know, even a good formula like the one that the Swiss psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross put forth, you know, the five stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, you know, people think they should be over it in a year, 2 years, 3 years, and when it doesn't happen, then they feel bad about themselves, like they're doing something wrong. And my point is that there is no formula, and that feelings have a life of their own, and we can learn to allow that to happen and learn from those feelings without trying to control them all the time.
You also intimate that the root of unhappiness, getting back to happiness for a moment, I'm remembering that article you did mm-hmm. in Psychology Today, is the inability to see ourselves properly, and the self-centeredness is what needs to be uprooted.
Yes. Well, and that's a difficult thing to uproot, self-centeredness, because according to the Buddhist psychologists, to uproot self-centeredness, you have to be able to find the self that you believe to be so real. So you have to find the place in yourself where you really, you know, are holding on.
But even that could be illusory like everything else.
Oh, what the Buddha said is that it is illusory like everything right. else. But you can't understand its illusory nature unless you really make room for it. If you just say to yourself, oh, it's illusory, then, you know, it's going to go on operating from behind the scenes, controlling what you do. So that becomes the challenge of a real meditation practice, to find the self that never existed in the first place.
It's also a story that you tell about the Buddha and a woman who comes to him disconsolate because she has a dead baby.
Yeah.
And it's a really useful and instructive story.
It's a profound story. She comes to him. She won't put down the dead baby, and the villagers are afraid of her, and everyone's like, you know, hiding from her. And finally, one guy takes pity on her and says, actually, there's someone over there who has medicine for this kind of thing. Why don't you go talk to him? There's like a doctor over there. And he takes her to the Buddha. And the Buddha says, yes, actually, I do have medicine for this. But first, would you bring me a mustard seed from a house in the village where no one has seen or felt death? And she says, oh, okay, I'll go get you the mustard seed, and goes out and can't find anyone who hasn't known death. The villagers tell her, the living are few, but the dead are many. And she talks to them all. She puts the baby down, comes back to the Buddha without the mustard seed. And he gives her his basic teaching, which is, you thought that you alone had lost a son, but death is everywhere. Everyone's vulnerable to it. All living things must perish. And she feels the wisdom and the kindness, really. She feels the kindness of the Buddha. He doesn't tell her that she has bad karma. You know, he doesn't tell her that she did something bad in a past life. He just tells her this is the nature of things. And she puts on the robes of a female mendicant, and then has a vision of the lights in the village, and you know, over the hill, and she sees the lights flickering, and she says, oh, I understand, my state is like those lamps, one moment lighted and the next extinguished. And the Buddha gives her a hug, you know.
Talking with Buddhist and psychiatrist Mark Epstein. His newest book is The Trauma of Everyday Life, and I invite you to join us. In fact, you can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, so if you have a question or comment for Dr. Epstein, or if you just want to talk with us about how you get through trauma, and some of you have managed to do that and may indeed provide some light for others. You know, there are different people sometimes have to do it in a different way, I think, and you may want to express your feelings about this. The idea behind this book has a lot to do with facing trauma head on, and the way out is through. Some people would say, oh, I just have to just block it and not face it, and that's how I got through it, keeping myself busy or whatever. I mean, all kinds of responses to what's called trauma. And you can join us again at our toll-free number. Please feel free to do that. It's 866-733-6786. If you have something you'd like to contribute to the conversation, we welcome your calls. Again, 866-733-6786 is the number to join us. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And, of course, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. Doesn't the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that Trinks use talk about trauma as the threat of death or serious injury?
Like? Yeah, it's a confrontation with death or serious illness in a way that arouses fear, horror, or terror, or helplessness.
So when you're talking about emotional pain, that's kind of a developmental trauma.
Yeah, then this idea of trauma has been applied to early childhood life, because children up to the age of three have very severe anxieties, but they don't have the secondary processing. They don't have the cognitive ability of language to be able to understand what it is that they're experiencing. So they're totally dependent on the parents to pay attention to what's going on inside of them, to intuit what they're feeling, and to make it okay. I talk about that as a kind of holding, not a physical holding necessarily, but holding in the larger sense of the word. And the parents, through a subtle process of like, oh, what's wrong? It's okay. Maybe you're hungry. Maybe you're tired. Make the intense anxiety feelings tolerable for the child. When that doesn't happen well enough, then there's what we call developmental or relational trauma. And that makes emotional experience in adult life much more difficult. And it makes the pressures of intimate relationships much more difficult, because those same kinds of anxieties tend to come up in our intimate relationships.
So what do you tell a patient who says to you, I have a lot of faith in you, doctor. I realize what you're saying. I respect your Buddhist principles and so forth. But when I'm feeling emotional pain, I just need to numb myself. I need to throw myself into hedonistic activities, or I need to, you know, inure myself to the pain.
Well, it would be great if someone could be that clear about what they're doing to avoid their problem. That's the usual way. That's what comes instinctively. Of course we want to numb the pain. And the whole psychotherapy encounter is set up to permit just a little bit more of the actual raw emotional experience than people are used to allowing. So a skilled therapist stays out of the way just enough to let a little bit of anxiety come up, a little bit of sadness come up. And we just touch it for a second, like what might be going on over there with you, you know? What do you think that dream really was about? You know, why do you think you're a little bit uncomfortable now? So it's not like letting the whole thing come flooding in. It's like little tiny bits at a time, and then the relationship, which is established over time, gradually allows a little bit more to be known. Because really, we're all big mysteries to ourselves. You know, we're carrying in our psyches, we're carrying our whole lives with us. Only bits of it do we really understand.
That's very Freudian, the idea that we're kind of this archaeological mess of things that we carry with us. And you mentioned dreams. You still think or put stock in the idea that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious?
Oh, definitely. Dreams are definitely the royal road.
I got to tell you, I've come around to a very different opinion. I've had so many dreams that have just been from everyday life, or so way out there and no associations. I can put myself on the couch and, you know, not find anything about the dream that, because I'm not a very repressed person. At least I don't think I am. So, and then there's all this new study about dreams and physiology. In fact, out of your alma mater, Harvard.
No, everyone wants to just reduce it to the random nature of the brain's activities and so on. But even your dreams about daily life, you know, there may be little bits of trauma hidden there, which is why you need to dream about them.
Well, we'll hear from our listeners again when we return. Feel free to join the conversation with Dr. Mark Epstein. I'm Michael Krasny. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Mark Epstein, who is a psychiatrist and an author. His newest book is The Trauma of Everyday Life. He's also a clinical assistant professor in psychotherapy and psychoanalysis at NYU, New York University. And he'll be at Book Passage, Corte Madera, 7 p.m. this evening. "We are all traumatized by life," he writes in his new book, but this isn't, according to him, necessarily a bad thing. In the book, again, the trauma of everyday life, he says trauma from death of a loved one to just everyday suffering, fear, and all of those kinds of things has benefits. And understanding and accepting trauma can lead to personal growth and change. You may want to add your voice to this, talk about how you've dealt with trauma, and we certainly welcome your involvement in the program. Our website is available to you to post any comments on. It's kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page, or tweet us at Twitter handle @kqedforum. Looking at a couple of emails here, I'm going to go to your calls, but two completely different views. Brian writes, he is exactly right. Trauma is trauma and exists across a spectrum. Brainwave function is impacted by all traumas to whomever, whatever extent. Also, set points can be changed easily with neuro and biofeedback. On the other hand, I have a listener who writes, I'm unconvinced this idea is novel or especially insightful. Surely most people realize this as they grow older, though most of us don't have a platform to articulate it or, dare I say, make a buck from it. That's a rather cynical remark, but let's get some response from Dr. Epstein.
Yeah, well, I do not think this is a novel idea. This, in fact, is the idea that the Buddha put forth 2,500 years ago, that there's a traumatic aspect to our lives. What I'm saying is that the instinctive reaction to that is a kind of rush to normal, is a kind of like, let's make this go away, let's get back to work, let's get over it. And I think that instinctive feeling was probably there in the time of the Buddha. It's certainly there in our culture. And I think it's to all of our detriment. I think what that leads to is a kind of fractured sense in many people where, like the woman I mentioned earlier in the show who lost her father but was not allowed to grieve publicly for him, where, you know, our hearts are locked up in around the traumas that we're not facing, and that makes us less than we could be otherwise.
Well, a couple things come to mind here. Like I say, I want to get to our callers, but for many people, obsessive thinking is almost unavoidable. They say, I can't stop thinking about that. I can't get blindsided by life or something happens along those lines and can't get rid of it, can't get it out of their mind or hearts. And for many people, there's also that sense of, and it's sometimes just almost reflexive, like getting your knee hit by a hammer, I'm a victim. I got hurt, and wallowing in that feeling, even though, you know, they may have every justification and right to feel that way.
Well, obsessive thinking is actually often a defense against a real feeling. So I think when you see someone who can't get the thoughts out of their head or are perseverating, that often there's something incomplete there, something incomplete in their emotional life. So if someone like that comes to me in therapy, I'm not so interested, obviously, in having them just repeat the thoughts, pretending that they're feeling the feelings. I want to look for what's really going on with them. And often it's a surprise because they don't know. They don't know and I don't know, but maybe we can find out.
Well, let's find out what our listeners have to say. And we begin, Marcia, with you. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Good morning. I come from a background that was both very physically and sexually abusive. I'm coming from a Christian background, I think a lot of people in the country do. We grew up with this notion that we have to forgive that. And that's not a concept, for me anyway, that really works. It was when I realized that some things, in the traditional sense of when someone does something to you, they have to make some kind of restitution, and there's this whole process of repentance, if you will. And when that can't happen, a person can get stuck. And it wasn't until I realized I don't have to forgive in the traditional sense, but the only way to move forward is the kind of acceptance that your guest is talking about. It happened, there is no restitution, and from there I take that experience, and I've said this to a lot of friends, I would not change anything that happened to me. I wouldn't ask for it. I mean, I wouldn't wish that on anybody, but nor would I change it, because all of it is part of the life experience that I have, which is fuller and richer in feeling through all of the experiences that I've had.
And isn't there something to the old axiom that some things are unforgivable?
Yeah.
I'm just struck by your story in that sense, Marcia. But I think this ties in with what you're writing, Dr. Epstein, that these experiences can, traumatic experiences can actually broaden your perspective, can make you a more deeply empathic and emotional person in many ways, in a positive sense.
Yeah. Well, I think also the forgiveness that is sometimes necessary in the kinds of situations that the caller is talking about is forgiveness towards oneself. Because so often when someone is the victim of the kind of domestic abuse or sexual abuse or violent abuse, something in them blames themselves. You know, there's a tendency to search around for a culprit. And often, you see this in children all the time when parents are getting divorced and so on. Often we zero in on ourselves, that somehow if we had only done something differently. And I think that notion of forgiveness, which when applied in this way, it can really free us from dragging around that sense of self-blame and of shame, really.
It's tough, though, and especially, I thank Marcia for the call. I've talked about this before. I don't like to talk about my personal experiences that much, but I got beat up as a kid in the sixth grade by a male teacher, and it was frequent. It was pretty bad, and I just had the sense, I guess, to say, you got to get through this and move on with your life. But when you're a kid, and it was certainly true for me, I thought, it's because I'm a bad boy, you know, it's because I'm, you know.
Yeah, that's the only way we know how to think.
And especially for kids, it's hard not to think that way.
No, it's impossible. Yeah.
Well, not. I mean, not. I suppose if you arm your children with enough of a sense of self-respect and knowing what's wrong, and I don't know that I had loving parents, but I don't know that I had enough of that. I just wonder where children can learn how to stand up for what's wrong and realize that these things are being done to them not because of their own culpability.
Yeah. Well, see, if they're allowed to talk about the things that happened, if you were allowed to talk about getting beat up, if you didn't feel such a deep sense of shame that you were keeping the experience from your parents and so on. It's in the relationships that we have with each other. It's in the conversations that we're able to have that we can learn not to do that kind of reflexive shaming or self-blaming and so on. That the feeling, you know, bad things happen, we have these feelings, we can talk them out, and then we're not necessarily stuck in those ways.
Told my parents years later, they were shocked. They said, you should have told us.
I know.
It's all hindsight. Yep. Let me get another caller on, and that's Elena. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Yes. Thank you so much for taking the call. And about a week ago, just today, I lost a friendship of 32 years duration, a wonderful, radiant person who struggled with health issues all her life and was very beloved in the community, of which she was part of several. And I also lost my dad 4 months ago, and I was exceedingly involved in the caretaking of both people. And
I'm so sorry. You've been through a lot.
It's been a lot. And I think what I wanted to really focus on for your audience is that my husband's a rabbi and part of a extended Jewish community here in San Francisco area. And when three things. One, when we were actually burying her, and there was so much crying. There were 140 people there. She was very, very beloved, the physician, and had cared for many people when she couldn't work anymore. She did phone consultations all the time. And it felt like this was something that had gone on for just throughout the ages of when somebody dies and is buried and the sense of loss, and there were so many people there to hug everyone who was having their moment of just intense grief. But past that, the Jewish mourning rituals of sitting Shiva, which you might know about, Michael, because I know that's part of your background, are very, very consoling, very, very helpful, because you're there and you're every night with people who knew the person. You can share stories. It's like their light and their radiance live on in all the shared memories. I'm very close to her sister, and that helps a great deal. So I think the combination of community and being part of somebody who many people know, that you know and you see them all the time, really has helped me a great deal, and also the actual specific Jewish mourning rituals. So that was what I wanted to share.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Certainly faith and community can help a lot with trauma. That's what I'm struck by. Dr. Epstein, you want to add anything?
Well, I think you can hear how important the community and the ability to talk the feelings out, how important that can be. Not everybody has that. And for people who don't have that built into their lives, that's why these traditions of both psychotherapy and meditation, that's why they're so helpful in these kinds of situations, because they afford that kind of opportunity for people.
And here's Lynn. Lynn, you're with us on Forum. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi, Michael. I actually have a query about the way in which people can deal with trauma. My kids, my family went through some very dramatic, traumatic situation many years ago. My husband was drowned in a rafting accident. The children were young, 12, 14, and 15. And, you know, we are, that's been part of our lives, obviously, and it's a memory that we don't forget. However, my take on this is, and I have said to my adult children, while that has informed their lives, of course, and mine as well, it has not identified them. And that's a distinct difference to me in the way in which people can handle traumatic experiences. And I don't know how to create that or how that comes about or what the difference is, but it makes a huge difference in healing. It's not, oh, gosh, I was 12 when my father died and it's, you know, been a sad thing for me all my life kind of thing. It's not like that. It doesn't identify who they are. And why is that? Why is that different?
Well, from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, of course, you're really on to something very important, because the self-concepts that we create out of our experiences, I'm feeling grief, but I'm a person who lost my father or lost my husband. We tend to fixate and around the concepts and then identify with the concepts, and then we're imprisoned by the concepts, rather than staying with the raw experience of the feelings, which are changing over time. And it sounds like instinctively, intuitively, you understood that and were able to help your family in the aftermath of what certainly must have been a shock.
And thank you, Lynn, for your call. Some emails here I want to read. Misha writes, I'm a senior at Mills College, and my mom died of cancer last summer. She was diagnosed during my freshman year of college, and I thought I prepared myself for her death during the 18 months between her diagnosis and her death. I told myself to face her death and not repress it. I wanted to grow from the situation, but since she's died, I found myself avoiding the trauma. I don't feel like I've grieved, and I almost just want to get it over with.
Yeah. Well, I think there's really no preparing yourself. That, you know, as much as you try, you just don't know how it's going to affect you. And you want to make a lot of room. You don't have to deal with it all right now. You know, it's going to be with you in some way. It's going to be with you as you go through your life. And allow that knowledge to be there, that, you know, in some surprising ways at some time, you may find yourself dealing with the feelings that that you haven't found a safe enough time or place to do that with yet.
I don't know if even expecting or preparing can help that much. I remember, you know, with some deaths that I've had to grieve, even though they were expected,
yeah,
even though they came in the course of time as they naturally would, and in some cases, like with my parents, they had pretty much checked out in terms of, you know, dementia and all that. But the finality of death is a real blow.
Yes, yes.
A real blow. There's just no doubt about it. No way around it. Excuse me. A listener writes, thank you for this wonderful show. A phrase I hear a lot is everything happens for a reason. I have never really liked the phrase. Of course, down the road, you can find some meaning behind a traumatic event and think about how it affected your life. However, it can seem almost shallow and an easy way out of explaining trauma, perhaps particularly for those with religious faith. On the other hand, I want to give David an opportunity to express his thoughts here. And David, you're a Christian and your religion got you through, huh?
I just remember thinking, consider it all joy, all your trials and temptations. That's in the Holy Scriptures. I can think of Paul, who writes in the Acts of the Apostles how he was beaten, whipped, shipwrecked, knocked around, stoned to death, and then came out of it, you know. And in my own life, I teach my kids, you know, pray. I think of people who say that I can't forgive. You know, I remember if I don't forgive somebody, someday somebody's going to want to ask for forgiveness from me. I'm going to want some for forgiveness. And it all goes down to relationships. The word joy in a Christian sense is Jesus, others, and you. And I know that when I give my problems to Jesus, and I know that it might be contradictory to a Buddhist sense, but I know that my Lord and Savior says, you know, my burdens are easy and my yoke is light, and it makes things so much better. And I don't have the struggles and the persecutions that I put inside my own mind when I deal with things now versus when I didn't. And I tripped over myself, and life got so miserable. And just really, I think, and there's a sense of delusion in some Christian senses that you have to give up. And if we just stay focused on that, there's a higher scheme of things spirituality-wise, that these trials and burdens and things, they're only temporary, and they will pass on.
Well, particularly if you believe in eternal life and you have that kind of faith as a cornerstone, it can be a great comfort, a great solace. Some thoughts from you, Dr. Epstein?
Well, the Buddha actually discovered within himself something that's remarkably similar to what the caller is describing. You know, he went through all of his own darkest sides, all of his traumas, all of the, you know, the pain that he was seeing in the whole world. And he found within his mind, within his heart, a capacity for a wise and joyful and kind awareness that could sustain him through all of the ups and downs, all of the tribulations, all of the impermanence that he faced. So I think our spiritual vocabulary changes depending what culture we come from, but there are some basic truths that can help us through.
I remember when I first began to read Buddhist writings. I mean, I was a kid, you know, like 17 years old.
Yeah,
or something.
Me too.
And suddenly there was this recognition that not only is everything impermanent, but, I mean, it came to me with not just notional assent, but Cardinal Newman says, but emotional assent, but also the recognition that that what life is loss and that impermanence, and that, you know, I think depending on how the Buddha is translated, he tells us that we all face disease, aging, death, no way around that. I don't want to get too morbid here.
But that's not the point.
That can also be a pretty heavy dose to take into one's bloodstream,
you know,
especially at a young age, and recognize. Too many young people, you know, have a life view that just takes them through without any kind of seriousness along those lines. But once you begin to take all that in and absorb it, it can be very heavy.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you're saying reminds me of when my wife and I met, which is now more than 30 years ago, but we were really in love, and I was so fortunate and felt so fortunate to be, you know, like to know that I was in love. And we both at the same moment were completely taken over by the reality of death. You know, in this young love, we were in our 20s, but suddenly the fact of death was like hitting both of us so strongly. And I think that connection somehow between opening to love and realizing its preciousness, you know, and the inevitability of its separation and loss, somehow those things need to come together, and they make things real.
And Mark Epstein's book is The Trauma of Everyday Life. Our next caller is Jay. Jay, welcome.
Hi, Michael and Dr. Epstein. My name is Jay, and I'm an Asian Indian man living in Concord. I had a very physically and emotionally abusive childhood, and I grew up very confused. And as I grew older, I started to have these feelings where I started to feel like I might have been abused, but I'd swing back and forth between I was abused versus I deserved it. My parents were just disciplining me. When I finally met my guru, the first thing I told him was, I'm always guessing what is normal. And he looked at me and he said, most people have to be told that you have this awareness that you know, and that's an indication of abuse if you have to guess what's normal when you're with people. So that gave me two things. It gave me a sense of self-worth that I was actually good at something, and it validated that I'd been abused and put an end to all that confusion. And then he gave me this this way to heal myself, where basically he told me to write in a book and address my inner child, and basically just ask the child, you know, what it was feeling and so on, and then reverse the grip on the pencil or the pen and hold it like a child would, and just let it flow. And he said that the child would come out and say what it had to say. And it took me years and years after that, because apparently the child had a lot to say. And, it was quite successful after that. I just wanted to share that as something that helped me heal.
Appreciate your sharing, and thank you, and stay healed. Good of you to call.
That's a very skilled guru.
Yeah, I would say so, too. Susan tweets, it's so interesting to have everyone's trauma valued. I so very much resent the gauge of normal. Seeing the hard parts is healthy. And Rick from Walnut Creek, could you ask Dr. Epstein on his views on addiction and the application of mindfulness practices as a part of recovery and therapy? It's a little bit off subject here, but we've done programs on it, and there's strong evidence that Buddhist practice can really help with addiction.
Yeah, I don't think it's so off topic, because many people who end up...
Well, they suffer because of addiction.
Yeah, many people who end up in addiction are actually fleeing from just the kind of confrontation with their own traumas that the callers are talking about, because the substances give some kind of palliation at first before the addictive thing takes over. But once the addiction takes over, then there's a kind of dissociation that's reinforced, where the traumatic feelings are never really being breathed. They're never really being metabolized. They're never really being known. So the huge function of the 12-step groups is to create a community where people can admit their vulnerabilities, you know. And that is meditative and psychotherapeutic in its essence. And now people are finding that the careful application of both mindfulness and psychotherapy can augment what people receive in those kinds of 12-step groups, because they help people to know and understand and explain what they're feeling.
Well, a lot of listeners are feeling, as a result of this conversation, let me just give a good sampling here of some responses from listeners. This one writes, Dr. Epstein's book comes at a time when the latest version of the DSM still classifies trauma based on specific types of events that could trigger trauma in a person's life rather than on clients' phenomenological experience of trauma. From personal and professional experience, I have found that a given trauma that one person thinks should be easy to resolve can linger painfully unresolved in another person. Trauma is in the eyes of the beholder. Another listener writes, trauma is a fact of life, trauma with big T's and little T's. A large amount of energy, sympathetic arousal, is mobilized during a traumatic experience. After the traumatic experience, there is a natural parasympathetic response that occurs, crying, shaking, trembling. It is when this counterreaction is prevented that the body stays locked in a state of arousal and we become symptomatic. Allowing the body to recover from stress and trauma is essential. And another listener says, I've lived with PTSD from a life-threatening car accident and also living with drug addicts. I've run the gamut from OCD to flashbacks and had years of therapy and body work. I finally feel some relief and a sense of normalcy, but the struggle has cost me many jobs and relationships. I appreciate completely what the guest is saying. I wish that our culture would be more open about the benefits of dealing with trauma and get rid of the shame around it. Not dealing with trauma is so much worse. Alexander writes, I recently lost a dear uncle in a sudden, brutal, and unexpected way. And a few years ago, I lost 4 grandparents in 4 years. As a graduate student of family therapy and an analysand of 3 years, including a year of 5 days a week analysis, I take emotion seriously. After the last of my grandparents died a couple years ago, I spent the better part of a year recalling memories of them and laughing and crying alone in the evenings in my home. After a while, the memories became played out, and I was able to move on to others and yet others. This process has eased into acceptance of the situation that they are ancestors and not ghosts, as you quoted earlier. How might the grieving process differ in this most recent case of loss to the loss of the unexpected, of the expected grandparent?
I wish I understood the last part of the question.
Well, the grieving process, he mentions initially his uncle dying brutally and unexpectedly, as opposed to grieving someone who dies in the, what could be called the normal unfolding.
Yeah. When the loss is brutal and unexpected, the emotional response goes running into hiding, you know, because it's just like it's too much to comprehend at first. So you have to be patient. You have to be patient with yourself and kind of look in the around the corners of your mind for the clues as to what you really might be feeling. And that kind of patient attention will allow the grieving to take its natural course.
Wendy writes, trauma seems to have taken center stage in the field of psychological treatment. What does Dr. Epstein think about the prevalence of framing psychological distress as trauma and treatments such as somatic experiencing?
There's a pendulum to everything in psychotherapy. You know, when Freud first began, everything was trauma, and then he moved away from that into the imagination and came up with his idea of neurosis.
And trauma is, as you say, center stage now. Even in literary criticism, there's a whole school.
Yeah, it's really come back. It's really come back front and center, and I'm sure it will be abused. But we're at a moment where it can be looked at again with fresh eyes. And that's what I'm hoping that my book will contribute to, that instead of saving trauma, you know, only for the most traumatized, that we can actually look to see where this notion is applicable for ourselves.
Let's get Kate on here quickly, if you could. Kate, join us, please.
Hi there, Michael. So it seems, just to sum up what I'm hearing from a lot of the callers and from your guest, is that a lot of dealing with trauma has to do with validation, whether you're getting it from within yourself or from an external source such as a counselor or a family member. But am I getting right here that to the extent that we're able to deal with trauma, we're getting validation for our experiences to help us accept them?
Yeah, I think validation is the important first step, and then there's a whole process of coming to terms with what actually happened and how you are relating to what actually happened. If you're pretending that it didn't happen, or if other people are pretending that what happened to you wasn't real, then there's no hope.
And so, let me thank Kate for the call. And on that note, we will conclude this interview. Thank you, Dr. Epstein, Mark Epstein, MD, psychiatrist, author of the new book, The Trauma of Everyday Life, and he'll be at Book Passage this evening, 7 p.m. at Corte Madeira. We're with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated. Daphne Miller will be with us in this hour. Another Harvard doctor wrote a book called Pharmacology, that's with an F-A-R-M. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer, Katie Springer, and Tina Larberg. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.